like last week, the passage is a little more lengthy. We did skip around a bit, but I'd like us to read the entirety of this passage, the 30 verses here, so that we get the full sense of the narrative. If you're able, let's stand for this reading of God's Word, Daniel 3, beginning with verse 1. Again, this is the Word of the Lord. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.' Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, 'Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?' Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning, fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.' Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning, fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning, fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace was overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning, fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, 'Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?' They answered and said to the king, 'True, O king.' He answered and said, 'But I see 4 men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods.' Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, 'Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here.' Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselor gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of these men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, 'Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him, and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. As far as the reading of God's word, you can be seated. Well, this may be the most well-known narrative or chapter in the book of Daniel. It is divided into half narrative and half apocalyptic or prophetic literature. And of the six or so chapters that have to do with narrative, this may be the well-known. If not, it's only second to chapter 6, where we find Daniel being thrown into the den of lions. It is memorable, to say the least. It is inspiring for the courageous, even heroic example we find in these three Hebrew men, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or, as we read several times, and as we know them better by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The commitment to the Lord we find in them, of course, we would hope to find in ourselves, even if we wonder if we were to find ourselves in such a predicament, if we would indeed be able to stand with the same courage and faithfulness to the Lord that we find here. Many Christians, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, have faced literal physical flames, the threat of persecution and the end of their lives in this way. But of course, most have not. And yet, even though we may not face literal flames, it certainly is a possibility, but even though we may not, or that it may be unlikely, there is still much that we find here, much truth, and much to be encouraged by, as we do face, of course, a variety of potentially fiery trials. So because regardless really of the trial, the fiery trial, that's a metaphor that Peter uses. He refers to the fiery trial, not to be surprised that we find ourselves in such a predicament, metaphorically speaking. But regardless of the fiery trial, we find encouragement here to remember that our God is powerful, that He's faithful, and that He's always present with His people. There are two things mainly I would like us to see tonight from this chapter. One is that the world pressures God's servants. We'll see that from Nebuchadnezzar and the demand to worship the image that he had set up. And did you notice how again and again and again it is the image that you have set up, that is set up. And then you have what is not set up. The God who is living and true, the one who is truly powerful, is the one who delivers. So clearly, one thing is the work of man. The other is the work of the Lord. But the world pressures God's servants. That's the first thing we'll note. A couple things under that, how they are pressured. And then we'll note that the Lord preserves His servants. The world pressures God's servants, but the Lord preserves His servants. So let's consider first how the world pressures God's servants. We saw last week in chapter 2, what we might say was an image of an image. That is, we were getting in our minds a picture of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had pictured or seen in his dream. It was a troubling dream. Remember, he lost sleep over it. He couldn't figure out what it meant, and he was about driven crazy with what it was and what the interpretation was of the dream. It was a great statue, a head of gold. No doubt this statue that actually comes to life in chapter 3, if it's not the same one that he saw in his dream, it certainly is meant to depict something of that, as he was told, you are the head of gold. And now we find in the very next chapter this great image, this great colossus, a tower that is made of gold. And the reference again to Nebuchadnezzar, you have set it up, you have set it up for this purpose. But it was a statue of gold, silver, bronze, and iron. And then, of course, chapter 3 opens with an actual image, an actual statue being built. It's not the largest of ancient statues, but it was still a colossus, an impressive thing. It would have been, from the measurements we have here, some 90 feet tall and about 9 feet wide. He set it up, we read, on the plain of Dura. It's probably some miles to the south but obviously it, within the province of Babylon, we're told here. And also it had to be close enough to where when the music was played, everyone would know that it's time to bow down to the image. And he and his officials, they dedicate the image, and then all the people, as we know, they're commanded. Peoples from every nation, every tongue, every people group of whom the Babylonians had conquered and brought to their land, they're all commanded to, when they hear the sound of the music, all the instruments that are listed there in verse 5 and in all the places that we see it, they're commanded that they will bow to this image. And the Jews are really pressured to play along with it. You think we find Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the only ones who are not bowing, apparently. But there were, of course, many other Jews in Babylon. We ought not speculate where Daniel is at this time. We've seen his faithfulness. Perhaps he was away on some administrative or emissary business. But God's servants here are pressured to play along. They too were to bow. And yet these three men that we have mentioned here, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we'll just call them by those names we know them by, that we've met them in chapter 1 and chapter 2. We've already considered them a bit as they were partnering with Daniel in chapter 1 and their refusal to eat meat from the king's table and drink his wine. And then chapter 2, Daniel goes to them when he hears the word that their lives are in danger, and they go to prayer. So we've seen them. We've considered a little bit of their faithfulness. But here they are again now coming into the spotlight, more so than Daniel has, since it's been Daniel up until this point mainly. But they refuse to bow to the image. This is a violation of God's commandments. For them, the first commandment and the second commandment. You shall have no other gods before me, and you shall not make a graven image to bow down to it or serve it or to worship it. And so the Lord had given his people this covenant on Mount Sinai, these commandments that they were to follow. They were, of course, dual citizens. They were now citizens in Babylon. They were to be concerned, as Jeremiah said, to be concerned about the welfare of the city, to where you go. And yet they were also remaining citizens of God's kingdom. And so now these two kingdoms are clashing. And they must, as citizens of God's kingdom, right? That takes precedence over their citizenship in Babylon. Their citizenship in God's kingdom prevented them from obeying the decree of the earthly king. They cannot violate God's commands in order to keep the commands of an earthly king. We're reminded again that Babylon, ancient Babylon, is even more ancient Babel that we see in Genesis chapter 11. And there, remember, there was another tower built, as we've already mentioned, even in this series of sermons in Daniel. That's where the Tower of Babel was built, that the Lord scattered the peoples and their languages from Babel into the earth. It was a tower that was like this one, though, intended to be inclusive, a tower intended to be for everyone, for all peoples. But we're also reminded that a diversified unity, as much as we might aim for something like that, a diversified unity at the expense of truth is no true unity at all. And it flies in the face of God's commands. That's what we find here. Now, we may not be pressured to bow to a literal image, but we certainly face all sorts of pressures, metaphorically speaking, to bow to the idols of our culture, to the standards and the ideals of the day, of the world. You can just imagine, this likely would have been with all the pervasiveness of idolatry in pagan countries. This would have been really the most natural thing in the world to do, just to add another deity to bow to. And so everyone's doing it. You know, it really, you can ask this question, you know, really, what's it going to hurt you just to bow to it? You don't really have to mean it. No one's asking you to renounce your God. That's not what they were asking. They were just asking, add this one. You know, just show your loyalty to the state here. If you truly cared for the welfare of Babylon, as you say you do, and as even your own God has commanded you to be concerned about it, then you'll comply to this. But of course, they couldn't. We said in chapter 1 that sometimes the lines of compliance and conformity may differ in certain what we might call gray areas, depending on conscience. Again, if you think back to chapter 1, we just maybe assume with a surface reading that that the food wasn't kosher, right? That Daniel refused something that violated the Mosaic law, the ceremonial law, and the dietary regulations. But we have no prohibition for wine in the Old Testament. Daniel refused the wine. Later on, we will see that Daniel fasts for a number of weeks, and then he returns to eating the delicacies that are given to him from the king's table. There was something, though, about this moment in the early exile where he was refusing to eat. Perhaps we said it was an identification with God's people and lamenting over why they were there. It just wasn't the time, perhaps, to be eating of these delicacies. We're not quite sure why. And so in areas like that, with matters of conscience, there may be a different line for different people as far as how far someone is willing to go to comply, to consider what is best for the glory of God. But when it comes to this area, there is no question. This is clearly a violation of God's commands. For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they don't need to think about it. They don't need to pray over it. They don't need to go to Bible college for 4 years and try to discern the will of God here as far as what they ought to do. Whenever they are summoned to appear before the king, did you know what they said to him? They answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." They could have reasoned, perhaps. We can bow physically, but truly we won't mean it in our hearts. They could have reasoned, perhaps. We can bow and comply because it'll be safer for us. And you know, the Lord has put us in this position after all. We have influence in the city. We have influence in the kingdom of Babylon for the sake of the living and true God. And we can continue that if we'll simply bow here. After all, what good are we as dead? But there was no question for them. For them, it was not complicated. As the Apostle Peter would later say in the book of Acts, when they were commanded, "Do not preach anymore in the name of Christ." Peter and the apostles had to respond, "Will you judge then to see if it's better to obey men or to obey God?" Peter says, for us, we can't. We must obey God rather than men. So they're pressured to play along. Well, then they're pressured with peril. That is the hazard, the danger here that we find. They're reminded of the consequences as they come to Nebuchadnezzar of what will happen to them if they continue this practice of nonconformity and refuse to bow. And yet they still refuse to bow. And so they're gone. Remember, he had preserved them in chapter 1 with only vegetables and water. He has proven to be the God who reveals dreams and mysteries. We saw in chapter 2. And so they are confident here that he has the power to deliver them from the flame. And they say they're confident he will. But if not, I love that. But if not, in verse 18, "Be it known to you, O king, we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." They're being tested here, but not just by Nebuchadnezzar. This is truly a test from the Lord himself. But if we think back just a couple of chapters, we're reminded very quickly, or we see very quickly, that this test didn't just come out of the blue. They've already passed a smaller test. They've already proven a smaller degree of faithfulness. And so here they are in a greater day, in a day of a greater trial, where smaller trials have prepared them for this day. Because we can't expect, can we, if we're not willing to be faithful in the little things, that all of a sudden, in the day of a great trial, that we're going to have this moment of courage. Of course, we depend on the Lord, and we look to him for grace in a day such as this one. But how can we expect if we haven't built faithfulness, endurance in the days of lesser things? So they were confident that their God could deliver them. Regardless, they're committed to his revealed will. He has specifically revealed you're not to bow before an image. You're not to have any other gods before him. Because in their estimation, though the tower of Nebuchadnezzar stood tall, the living and true God, the God of heaven, stood much higher than the tower, the statue that Nebuchadnezzar had built. Like marriage, our covenant with the Lord is one that requires us to forsake all others. We're to have a wholehearted devotion for Him. He will tolerate no idols. And so there's no room for rivals. There can be no, for them, there was no price tag on their devotion. It wasn't as if, okay, we'll go this far. No, they were willing to give their very lives. Be it known to you, O King, even if our God doesn't deliver, and we're not going to bow to your idols. We're not going to serve your gods. Of course, Paul tells us in Romans chapter 12 that we're to present ourselves to the Lord in this way, with a living sacrifice, devoting our bodies, devoting ourselves to Him. Peter tells us we're not to be bewildered when, or think it a strange thing when we find ourselves in the midst of a fiery trial. This is, though, what they're doing here is what Kevin DeYoung, the way he puts it, it really is one of the marks of true faith. They're putting their confidence in God's power when they don't know God's plan. They're putting their confidence in God's power. They're committing to His will, even when they don't know if there's going to be a happy ending here, so to speak. So the world pressures God's servants. But then, secondly, we see that the Lord preserves His servants. The world pressures God's servants, but the Lord preserves His servants. So we have this threat of the fiery furnace, and to be honest, we don't know a lot about it, about its dimensions or anything really, other than what it was and what it was being used for here, what these men were threatened with. There is evidence, however, from the ancient Near East of such ovens existing during this time. But they're bound and they're thrown into the furnace. But note, they're not just thrown in. They are bound in their cloaks and tunics and hats, all their garments. That's going to play an important, it'll be important here in detail in a moment. But they're thrown into the furnace, and the king is so furious, remember, that he demands that the furnace be heated seven times more than it normally was. And so even the mighty men, right, we read in verse 19 of some of the of those who were, verse 20, rather. Some of the mighty men of his army, they bind them and cast them in. And those who threw them in, we find that this was done in such a hurry, and the fire was heated so much beyond its normal temperature that those who threw them in actually were burned and killed by the flames. We see that in verse 22. And this is where the king is astonished. Verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the fire? And then in verse 25, he said, I see four men, and they're not bound. They're walking around, and the fourth man has the appearance of a son of the gods. So these three are preserved in the flame, cast in bound, and yet within the furnace, they're freely walking around, unharmed. Unharmed so much so that when they're released again with their clothing, we find no evidence even. There's no evidence on appearance on them that they had been burned. The hair of their head was not singed. Their clothing, right? The highly combustible garments are fine. And even you find, you know, kids, you know what it's like to be around a campfire, and what happens later on? You can still smell it on you, right? It's in your hair. It's in your on your body, it's in your clothes, and you take those off, and you your mom washes them later or the next day, and she picks them up, and she can smell the fire on the clothes as well. But here, we find that warming yourself by a campfire would do more damage than what this fire, this oven, heated seven times beyond its normal, thrown right into the midst of it. A campfire does more damage to us by leaving a smell on our clothing than this oven did to these men. They've been completely preserved, completely delivered. And the king realizes here that what they had said had come to pass. Their God had indeed delivered them. It's as Nebuchadnezzar says in verse 26, as he calls out to them in the furnace, servants of the Most High God. He's the one who has delivered them. And this is, he understands this by the presence of a fourth man in the fire. Again, did we not cast three inbound? And yet there's four. They're free. They're walking around. And there's a fourth one there. Clearly, again, as he has an appearance like a son of the gods, there is clearly something different about that fourth man. Something that differentiated him from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar took note. He could notice this. So they trusted in the power of God to deliver them. The Lord proved to be just as powerful as they said he was. And so we are reminded here that our trials, right, no matter how fiery, they don't diminish the Lord's power in any way. He's not bound. He's not limited by the threats or the actions of wicked men. And yet, as we said at the beginning, there have been a number of saints who have died in the flame, literally. There have been those who have been burned at the stake. Their bodies consumed. They weren't delivered from the immediate flame as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Here you are maybe familiar with Latimer and Ridley, the English martyrs during the Reformation. They were burned at the stake, but they encouraged one another with the belief that though they were, their lives were going to be given over to the temporal flame, that they were encouraging one another by believing that they were lighting a flame in England that day that couldn't be quenched. And it was true. The Reformation continued to spread in the earth like it was a fire from heaven. So, of course, we know our God, his power is not altered by men, their threats, their actions. And our God is the same. His power today has not been altered. And neither has this fact that just as the Lord was present with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego here, he is continually present with his people today in all they endure, all their trials. And so there is, Christian, a fourth man present in the furnace of affliction with you. Now, there's been debate, of course, as to the identity of who this fourth man is. We wonder, is this the pre-incarnate Christ? Is it an angel sent from the Lord? But regardless, the truth remains the same, that God himself promises to meet us in the midst of the furnace, in the midst of our trials. He promises never to leave you or forsake you. He promises, as Jesus said in the Great Commission, to be, I'll be with you always, even to the end of the age. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they are those that the author of Hebrews says that by their faith they quenched the flame. But of course, the power didn't reside in their faith in itself. It was in the God in whom they placed their trust. So the Lord is preserving his servants. He has preserved them with his presence, but he also preserves them here with his promotion. They're freed from the furnace. In verse 26, they're called to come near. And then Nebuchadnezzar brings them out. In verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar blesses their God, the one who has sent his angel, he says, and deliver his servants who trusted in him. For what they did, they set aside the king's command. They yielded up their bodies, loving them their lives even to the death, as they yielded up themselves rather than violating the command of God here. And so freed now, Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges it is the Lord who has delivered them. He decrees as he blesses the Lord that no one is to speak anything against the God of these three. And then furthermore, we find in verse 30 that he promoted them. They go from the furnace of affliction to a promotion from the king. The king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. This is, we should be careful to note, this is not quite a conversion. Regardless of the good things that Nebuchadnezzar had to say, he has already seen. In the last chapter, we saw him give honor to Daniel and to Daniel's God because he is the God who reveals dreams. So Nebuchadnezzar has seen twice God's wisdom and his power manifested in these unremarkable and undeniable ways. But actually things get worse for him as we go to into the next chapter. We'll see how Nebuchadnezzar had to be humbled by the Lord for his pride until he understood that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will. This sadly reminds us, doesn't it, of those who have witnessed the Lord's power. Perhaps they've had the motions of God's Spirit at work in them, and yet their conversion was temporary or superficial. Many of us have witnessed that, those types of temporary conversions, or seen those who are shaken, as it were, and yet remain unconverted. They're not the product of those superficial things are not the product of true regeneration by God's Spirit. Someone put it this way, Nebuchadnezzar's heart, both in chapter 2 and chapter 3, his heart was shaken, and yet it remains unrenewed. And yet there is a clear acknowledgement of God's might and care for his own. And it comes through the faithful witness of his servants, of these three. They were rewarded for their faithfulness. Now, we've seen that this is a pattern. We've seen the reward in three ways. They take the stand in chapter 1, and they're rewarded for it in chapter 2. They reveal Daniel reveals the mystery to Nebuchadnezzar. He's rewarded and promoted for it. And now in chapter 3, we find them taking a stand for God's command, and they are rewarded for this as well. The Lord honors those who honor him. This is not to say that in the same way we can be sure that the Lord will reward faithfulness in the same way, or that just because you're going through a trial, a furnace of affliction, that a promotion is coming soon. That's not the application we're to take from this. But we are to know that we can be sure of this. The Lord does reward faithfulness to him. Your faithfulness to the Lord is never in vain. It never is. So what we find in this narrative is really that it is saturated with truth for us to be encouraged by. One truth that we need to remember is that this narrative itself is true. It is not a fairy tale. It comes to us as history, as the truth of God's word. But at the same time, as we encounter fiery trials, even if it's not a physical flame as it was here, a physical furnace, we still encounter things that are very difficult. And the church of Christ has always and continues to. In the days of the Reformation, the French Reformed leaders adopted the burning bush as their seal. And that burning bush was then carried on by Scottish immigrants. And it became the official emblem of the Free Church of Scotland. You even see it today in the Reformation Study Bible, some of Ligonier's promotional material. It is demonstrating that though the Church of Christ may face flames, right? The threat of persecution, like the burning bush, God's presence in Exodus 3 that Moses saw, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. The church may be burned like these men thrown into the furnace and yet not consumed. The Lord preserves his servant. He delivers and he's present with his people. But we are reminded again that there are those who have not been delivered from the physical flames. We are not promised, we're not guaranteed that we'll be delivered from all of our immediate trials. But at the same time, our faithfulness to the Lord is to be the same as it was for these three, for the saints that we meet here. That regardless of what we face, our attitude is to be this: we are confident that our God has power to deliver. But if not, we will remain faithful because our God is faithful to us. The fact that our God is faithful is to be an anchor for the soul. No matter the trial, we can know that the Lord meets us there. He's with us. And whether it's in this life or the next, he ultimately will promote and honor and deliver his people. I'll close with this from Isaiah 43:2, the Lord promises us there, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. Let's pray.